Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Our guest this week is the fine ESPN senior correspondent, Tom Rinaldi. You know his work from college football, from tennis and golf, where he's interviewed people like Nick Saban, Roger Federer, and Tiger Woods, as well as some of the amazing feature work that he has done. Tom Rinaldi is usually at the center of the ESPN features that provoke emotion and just are incredibly memorable when you have watched them. It's a conversation about how Tom Rinaldi does what he does, including his writing process when he is charged with writing a script, sometimes on stories that involve living and dying and sickness, and he does it about as brilliantly as we have seen anybody do it in sports. So Tom Rinaldi, senior correspondent of ESPN, is the guest. I think you will enjoy this conversation. Okay, and we bring in the fine ESPN senior correspondent, Tom Rinaldi, taping this, basically, Tom, fresh back from England, correct? And interviewing Roger Federer. And is it Garbine Muguruza? Am I close?
That is correct. I give you very high marks for your it's Garbine, yay. So there's a little N, yay,
right,
there, and then
up.
It's Muguruza. Yeah, Muguruza.
I would have practiced that beforehand. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated podcast. And let's start with this. I want to ask you very open-ended questions, which is what you do so well. How would you define a good interview question?
That's a great question in and of itself. And I would say typically, but not all the time, Richard, it's open-ended, it's short, and you oftentimes don't know the answer. You really want to know the answer. And I think that there are many times where the simplest question gets the best answer. And maybe that's a good thing for me as a simple man, because I try not to freight down the questions with any proofs of all I know, because I probably don't know that much. So I try to keep the question short, simple, and open-ended.
Tom, you're coming off, obviously, interviewing multiple people at Wimbledon, Roger Federer very prominently. Obviously, historically, you have interviewed many well-known people, coaches in college football, et cetera. So when you are about to interview an athlete or a coach following his or her victory, how much preparation have you done on those questions before the interview versus asking questions in the moment when their answers strike you as needing a follow-up?
That's, again, another great question, Richard, and I think that's a process that I'm continuing to try to learn, to strike that balance correctly. I think early on when I started to do it, I was the guy with the card, with the questions, as if they were tablets, and that's a mistake. You have to listen to what the athlete or the coach is actually telling you and respond off of that. Sometimes the answers are fully formed, as in the case with Federer, who I've known for quite a while and I have a certain measure of comfort with, that I know I can ask him virtually anything and he'll give an engaged and an answer that he's thought about. But sometimes somebody takes you into a place that you didn't expect. And oftentimes, Richard, I don't know if you see this, but sometimes when I see other interviews do this, and I do it too, hopefully less so now than I once did, but I guarantee I'll continue to do it in the future. Somebody tells you something very interesting, which begs a follow-up. And many times, too many times, I will go to that next question on the roster rather than, hey, wait a second, that person said something interesting, let me follow. So that's a balance I'm still trying to continue to find.
Tom, before we get into your features, which a lot of people obviously are going to be interested in, specifically younger people in the business who listen are always interested in how someone like you approaches writing scripts for, you know, 7, 8, 9 minute features. But staying on the topic of interviewing, one of the very, very famous athletes that you have interviewed many times and seemingly have a very good relationship with, at least professionally, is Tiger Woods, who is a very different interview, obviously, than Roger Federer. What has been your approach to interviewing Tiger Woods?
You know, from the very beginning, and I think if he were on this phone call right now, he would j- jokingly but truthfully, I think, say the same thing. He has been inexplicably cordial to me. Tiger has been. And the reason I say it's inexplicable is because if we together were to ask him, why have you shown that degree of cordiality to Rinaldi? I think he would laugh and say, I have no idea. I think that's probably the truth. I will say this as one mild suggestion, and then I'll add a sort of a quick postscript, Richard. The first is, the first time I ever did a sit down with Woods was after he had won the Masters. I'm trying to remember the exact year, but I wrote him a thank you note for sitting down. And Sal Palantonio, for example, a colleague of mine, does this as well. If anyone sits down, and I don't do it as often as I should, but I try to do it in each instance, I write a thank you note. And so I reached out to Mark Steinberg, as you know, Woods' agent, and I said, I have this note. You know, if I send it to you, will you give it to him? Steinberg, in a very funny reply, was like, well, what else am I going to do with it? I don't want it. So I wrote the note, and I didn't see Woods again until the U.S. Open that same year, which perhaps was at Pinehurst, if I'm remembering correctly. I'm not certain. So I hadn't seen him in a few months, and he did a press conference, and then there was a sort of a gaggle afterward of reporters, something that became less and less frequent with Woods through his career. He was done with the gaggle, and he was walking out a back door of the press tent, the media center, and he saw me out of the corner of his eye, and he said, thanks for your note. And I never forgot that. It surprised me so much, the simple gesture of writing a thank you note. And to update it to right now, I hadn't seen Novak Djokovic. I did not go to the Australian Open this year. So the last time I saw Novak Djokovic was at the U.S. Open almost a year, 9 months ago, right, or 10 months ago. And he came in, he did a sit down with us. And at the very end of the sit down, very short, right, 8 minutes, 6 minutes long, something like that, he gets up, you know, he shakes my hand. Again, this guy knows how many journalists and how many people and all the stops he makes in a global sport. And he just says, hey, I appreciate those notes, Tom. Thank you. And then he walks out of the room. Simple thing like that. And for whatever reason, whatever that seems to do to connect the athlete to the interviewer, the reporter, whether it's an acknowledgement of, hey, I know you do a lot of these, I'm appreciative, we don't take it for granted, you know, things of that nature. And I can also tell you that as the years have endured, and Tiger Woods has been through a lot of different things in his life of his own making and beyond, that handful of times, one in particular, Richard, in my life, when I suffered a loss in my life, I got a note back, and that was from Tiger. Had no idea how he found out about it, none, but he took the time to send me something, and he's just always been very cordial to me, and I've appreciated it.
Tom, I appreciate you sharing that. Here's my one question for you. I don't ask this pejoratively. I truly want insight. Do you often think about the line between you send a note like that, and it's certainly thoughtful. No one would argue that. But does it ever, in your mind, do you worry about crossing the line of being a objective observer of these guys to something closer when you start having sort of, for lack of a better phrase, personal correspondence?
All the time. And I think that all the time, that's a concern. And again, I'll give you a quick story as an aside here. But let me give a bit of a disclaimer before I do, to say that, listen, at Columbia Journalism School, we're told over and over about keeping your professional dynamic with the people that you cover. It's a must, and I agree with that. But what I agree with less so is the notion that somehow being a journalist comes at the expense of being human. That I don't subscribe to. And I realize that there's being human is such a broad term, it can border on meaningless. But there are times where I think journalists don't do the human thing because they don't think it's right. And that I subscribe to less. You used a word. It's sort of a radioactive word in my house where I'm talking to you right now. And the word is relationship. I was covering a golfer years past, and I had to ask him some difficult questions in a press conference because we were concerned that Sports Illustrated may have been on the verge of writing a story which would, I guess, best be called an expose about some of the golfer's foibles. And so I was told by one of our editors, who I greatly respect, listen, we need to just get on the record. We haven't been able to get a sit down. We haven't been able to get him off to the side. So in this press conference setting, you need to ask him. And this is a question that would be difficult, a guy that I know well. So I asked him. He handled the question beautifully and in his own way kind of turned me into a punchline in the room. And a lot of the other reporters laughed. And afterward, I didn't feel great about it. So talking to my wife, and she said, what's the matter? And I explained what happened in the press conference, and she knows the golfer. And I said, listen, not only did I not get any sort of substantive or meaningful answer, but he turned me into a punchline, and, whatever relationship I had with the guy has taken a hit for no benefit. She responded by saying, what relationship? Later that year, under the Christmas tree, the very first gift he gave me, he hands it to me, I open it up, and it's a sweatshirt. And stitched into the breast are two words, what relationship? Question mark. So believe me, I'm cognizant of it. I am. But I also want to be human at the same time. It's a tricky line.
Yeah, for sure. It's a good answer. All right, let's talk about some of the longer form pieces that you have worked on. Let's start at the beginning. How often are these stories found by you or found by a producer?
I would say if we're going to use the Mendoza line as not a batting average but a pitching percentage, I am well below it. I'd say a lot of the stories that I pitch go nowhere. Some of them do, but a lot of the stories that I'm assigned to do not come from me. They come from producers, and obviously in what we do, Richard, ideas are, I guess you could make the case that this is true in any pursuit, that ideas are the greatest currency. So for example, College Game Day, there's a master grid of feature ideas, and it's broken down into schools and where it might apply on a given week, given that year's schedule, et cetera. But a fraction of those stories actually get produced. But isn't it wonderful to have 10 ideas for every one that you can actually begin to put into production and then ultimately place on television and, across.com, et cetera. So, I try to pitch. I don't pitch nearly as often as I should, but I'd say the vast majority of the pieces that I do don't come from my own pitching.
Tom, can you take us through the process and go as long as you want? The story gets known. It's assigned. You have a producer, yourself, camera crews, editors, whoever else is part of it. You're going off. People are doing the reporting. You do the sit down with the main subject. Take us through the whole process from the beginning of that to the point, and that I want you to stop at this point, to the point where you were about to sit down and write.
I'll give you an example, Richard, of a story that we did last year, right? And this was a story of a boy, Logan Schoenhardt, who had a connection with Tom Brady. And this is a boy who had been plagued with a brain tumor from the time he had just passed infancy, from the time he was a toddler. And when we met him, he was 10 years old. So prior to going up and sitting with his family, we discovered the story because the tremendous producer, Ben Hauser, who produces pieces, oversees pieces, helps run E60, and is just phenomenal. His children go to the same school that Logan goes to in New England. And, you know, the story had not been reported anywhere other than people in this school community knowing about this boy and what he had been going through. So he becomes aware of it, and everyone knows in the school that he's a huge Patriots fan and that he loves Tom Brady. Ben Hauser has done other stories with Tom Brady, having him voice them over for E60, for the marathon, the Boston Marathon special, the Patriots Day anniversary, things of that nature, Richard. So he felt that, listen, whether there's ever a story here, maybe we can reach out on behalf of the family and see if there's a way that we can create a special day for, if you will, for Logan. Ultimately, reaching out to the family and asking what their interest might be in sharing Logan's story, and not including anything about whether he would meet Tom Brady or have a day with the Patriots, et cetera. The family said yes, because they felt as though, A, they wanted, in their own way, to try to pay tribute to their son's courage through this fight with this brain tumor, and that they wanted to draw attention to pediatric cancers, which at times, sadly, don't receive the attention that some other afflictions do when it comes to research dollars and public attention, media coverage, things of that nature. So ultimately, we got on the phone with mom and dad. We talked through what we wanted to do. Ben arranged to have an absolutely phenomenal crew. Mike Balaka was with us, his crew. Dan Lindberg was assigned to produce the story as well. He's a fantastic producer. And all of those pieces were put in place. Ultimately, we scheduled a visit. This was in the midst of the college football season. But we knew that we wanted to center the story, if we could, on one visual. And the visual is that prior to the last brain surgery that Logan endured, he asked the surgeon who had done the five previous surgeries if he could etch Brady's number 12 onto his skull plate.
Wow.
Before placing it back after doing the work he was trying to do to remove the tumor. The surgeon was so surprised, and et cetera, but ultimately, he did it. And that image, the image of the 12 etched into Logan's skull through several friends removed from the surgeon, made its way to Brady. And so Logan woke up one day to receive a message in his inbox from Tom Brady. Just a simple video message paying tribute to his fight, thanking him for his fandom, telling him, I'm a bigger fan of you for the courage that you're showing, all the things that you would hope that an athlete might say to a boy who adores him. The message is about 45 seconds or shorter than that. All those pieces were in place prior to us going up and visiting the Schoenaerts in their home. And that led to me doing the sit-down, first with his mom, then with his dad, then with his sister, and ultimately with Logan up in his room. And by that time, it had been made clear to Logan by his parents that there was nothing else that anybody could do medically, that he was going to die as a result of the tumor. And a bucket list had been created, and number one on that list, through Logan's own choosing, was to try to meet Tom Brady. We sat down with him, and I'll take you right up to the moment before I started to ask him any questions. But in a setting like that, Richard, one thing that I do, Ben does, Dan does, is we want to have a parent. Logan is 10, more than capable of, and is a smart boy. What he had been through had compromised his speech slightly, had not compromised him cognitively at all. And we interviewed him on his bed, in his bedroom, as you can imagine, a shrine to Boston sports teams. But we had one of his parents in the room, but out of his eye line, as a governor.
Right.
And that's what we ask for. If you feel mom or you feel dad like we're moving into a spot which makes you uncomfortable on behalf of your child, you stop us. And that's the point I'll take you up until.
When that's a heavy story. When the interviews are completed, and you and Ben in particular sort of feel like you've gotten everything you need in terms of video, in terms of the reporting, in terms of the story, what is your writing process, as detailed as you can, including where you write? And I guess I should ask in that, Tom, do you know beforehand sort of how long the feature is going to be, so you have to write to a certain time? But I don't really know much about writing television scripts, so I'd be interested in whatever you have to say in terms of where you write, how you approach the writing, how many drafts you do, and how you know what the time limit is on the writing.
Well, all of those are, especially the time question, Richard, shows a very informed sense of what we do. You know, in print, whether it's, again, to go to the ancient world of physical papers, whether it's, you know, inches, obviously that comes down to seconds and minutes on TV. We knew that we wanted to air the story. We had the Patriots one time on Monday Night Football on our schedule, and we had them on 12-12. We had them on December 12th. So we knew, all things being equal, that was the perfect time in the pregame lead-up to that game, that that's when we would want to air that feature. However, having said that, you really then have to work very closely with, in this case, you know, Matt Garrett, I believe, who was producing Monday Night Countdown. You have to respect the show that the piece is going to be placed into, what its time parameters are, how long it can, what length of piece serves the show, as well as where it's placed. We will, Dan Lindberg and I and Ben, and I would never want to minimize Dan's role. He was phenomenal in, you know, in everything he did in this piece. You know, our concern is always, you know, listen, we think it's a special story. We think this is a very special family. You know, we need some time. And in doing it, you know, across the 8 o'clock hour, Richard, which is a peak viewing time for us as people are getting ready to tune into a Patriots game, that's where the story was placed. And it ran at about 9.5 to 10 minutes long, which is really long, in that close to kick, where people have, by this point, grown to expect a lot more exo analysis, a lot more warm-up routine, a lot more shots that fly around the field and give you the urgency and immediacy. You know, you've gone the absolute other way. You've gone to tape, to a boy's bedroom, all those things, which are as far away from the joy and spectacle and urgency of a big-time NFL game as you can get. So we're grateful for that chance. I mean, immensely so. A 12-minute version aired on E60 after it debuted in that spot. So that's a very long answer to get to this point. Time is always a negotiation. Whether it's College Game Day, which is 3 hours long but has a lot of voices in it, a lot of elements in it, it's difficult. You always have to be mindful of serving the show. What's best for the show overall? You know, storytellers, Richard, are selfish by nature. They want to do the best they can on their story. And in particular, we want to honor the trust that a family is placing in us. So when we lose seconds and minutes, we oftentimes fight like hell to preserve or get them back. Not out of vanity or feeling that what we're doing is somehow different or superior or separate, but because we feel we want to honor the trust that's placed in us in telling them certainly stories of this kind of nature. So time will forever be the ultimate resource. Not only time, Richard, to put it together, time to shoot it, time to have it edited, all those things are crucial, but ultimately time on tape, TRT, on your television, on .com. How long do you get to tell the story? And not every story is better, longer, but sometimes stories of this nature, at least, you know, again, maybe we're too close to it to see it for what it should be. We feel a lot of times those stories really do benefit from additional time. Once everything's shot, everything is logged, the logs come back, and different producers do things different ways, and I work differently with different producers, and I work, Richard, with everybody from going out on their second or third field shoot ever to people like Dan and Ben who have multiple Emmys on their shelves at home. So different producers like to work differently. My favorite way to work is to talk to the producers about our agreed story points, what those are, to then take our sound and group it according to story point, many times realizing, Richard, that here's 12 bites about this story point and two are going to get in. And then my favorite way to work, a way I work with Kristen Lapis, for example, who's another fantastic producer, works on College Game Day as he featured, is to get on the phone and do it together. And sometimes, as you can imagine, those phone calls are 2, 3, 4 hours long, longer. And typically I'm writing in our house in northern Jersey, very close into New York City. We live in a wonderful little house. I do not have an office, so many of the times these phone calls are happening at the kitchen counter, kitchen table, or downstairs in our basement, which is largely devoted to our two kids and their artwork and things like that. So that's where I do a lot of the work that I do writing-wise. That gets done. A draft gets submitted. All the while now, Richard, I think as we've evolved as a company and technology has evolved, we're not waiting, sitting on our hands for our editors to go through things solely on paper. Right? We're now in the process of making the first rough cut so that our editors have an informed perspective on, all right, here it is on paper, and here's what the bones look like. What do we like? What don't we like? And then it becomes a collaboration. And you know, again, as I continue to mention names, Victor Vitarelli, who oversees SC Featured and all the feature unit that serves SportsCenter and other platforms, is an unbelievable partner in that regard. Andy Tennant with E60 is phenomenal in that regard. What I mean by phenomenal, Richard, is they listen. They listen to your perspective, and they try to improve with a reason. No one is ever saying, not no one, but it can be hard to hear somebody simply say, this would be the same thing for anything you write. It just doesn't feel right. that's just hard to hear. That's not good enough. If you have a reason for why you've included something, structured it a certain way, designed it, built it, then I think you want a reason back for a change rather than simply something as subjective as it doesn't feel right. And I think the people I just mentioned are terrific. Craig Lazarus as well, oversees the storytelling, terrific at trying to give a reason for the way something should be changed, restructured, cut, expanded, et cetera. That's a really long answer. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll say something quickly about Logan, is, you know, I talk to young journalists often, and one thing I tell them, Richard, is, and I hope I don't sound like, you know, I've worked other places, I've had other jobs, TV isn't the only thing I've ever done, so I hope I don't sound like a company shill when I say this, and you know the landscape enough to know that this isn't a shill line. The money that the company spends on long-form storytelling is just uncommon. It's phenomenal if you do what I do.
Yeah, there's no doubt that ESPN, I mean, there's a lot of things to be critical about them, but that's not one. I would argue probably the best feature producers in any content form on television, whether it's news, features, et cetera. I think it's the best collection or the best group that exists today on linear television. And you are correct. You just watch these features. You watch the high quality. You watch the editing. You watch the travel costs. And just look at the talent. Just look at how crisp the production is. It costs a lot of money to pay that kind of talent. So you are correct on that. That is one place that ESPN has always been strong. I want to ask one more question on this, and that is, how do you find the line not to be overwrought or melodramatic in your delivery? But here's the deal: like on the story you just described, there really isn't any way to avoid the emotion and drama of a young boy who we know is going to die. There's no way around that. So how do you work to find whatever the right tone or chord is?
I am still trying. I am still trying. Because to me, the one thing I'm so aware of not, and this is, no one wants to, you know, you want to achieve something. You want to work towards something. You don't want to work away from something. Yet it is so firm in my mind to try, and I fail so often at it, not to be overwrought, to be simple. And I think the more I do this, the more I've discovered that letting the sound achieve the power of the story is, at least for me at this point, seems to be the best course. Not to be adjectival in the writing, not to be overwrought, not to be overdone. And also in the way it's narrated or tracked, Richard, not to pause and, if I really like a line, read that line with the subtext being, I really like this line. Not to do that, which I think I still do. And the truth is, a lot of times the lines just aren't that damn good to begin with. So just read it. Just read it. And let the incredible pictures, editing, and sound really carry the power and the center of the story. Work to frame it. Work to frame it. And in doing so, you know, perhaps present theme, but not with a hammer. Present theme as an offering, not as a mandate. And not to overwrite. And I try not to. But I also get into it sometimes at the producer's, Richard, because I work hard to track something, not stoically, but evenly. Not in a way where it's manipulative. And still, I'll hear the cut. I'll get the, you know, a cut back, and it's been opened up. Someone will space out the words in the line as it was read to what airs. It's, you know, a third longer. And I try to push back and say, you know, I'm not rushing. I'm just saying it, just reading it. That's all. So trying to find that balance is hard. And again, to go back to the young journalist line, I get so many cracks at the greatest stories out there. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's a lottery winning gig. And we haven't even, you know, really talked about the remote part of it, the live event part of it, which is phenomenal.
Right.
Because that balances out the features. And just real quick postscript, Richard, on Logan. So, well, we did the story. Logan ultimately did meet Tom Brady. And we had one camera there. And I think in one of the better decisions we've made in a feature I've been a part of recently, we only showed the stills of their meeting.
Hmm.
And I think the decision for that visually was because that helps to preserve some of the wonder, some of the ineffable mystery of a child meeting his hero. And it was, I think, a really good decision.
I hate to ask this. Is Logan still with us?
He is not. He passed a short time after the Patriots won the Super Bowl.
Oh, man.
He and his family was invited to go, but Logan wasn't well enough to make the trip.
Oh, man. That is heavy. Features to work on. There's no great segue, obviously, from going and talking about the death of a young person. Both of us obviously have young kids. You can't even sort of imagine what their parents are going through. But in the course of obviously doing research, when I knew I was going to talk to you, it's interesting that in an interview with the Louisville Courier-Journal a couple of years ago, you said something that struck me, and I'll take you at your word that this is honest. You said that you've never looked yourself up on the internet. Is that correct? And if it's correct, why?
Two reasons. I'm not on social media, and I haven't looked myself up on the internet. And the night before we were going to do the first interview, never is wrong. This is the time. There was a time where I did, and then I stopped. And I stopped the night before we did the first interview with Woods after the implosion in his personal life.
Okay.
You know, Richard, that's a tough spot. It was a great spot and a tough spot. The best way to come out of that interview is, in a way, by having been a good umpire or a good official and do the job, ask the questions, and have all the focus be on his answers. And to this day, I still don't know how that interview has been graded out by others. I know that I did the best I could. I know that the company liked it. I know that I continued to have a working relationship with Tiger after it, et cetera. And I don't think I was soft. I don't think I came at it as some higher moral ground than when he stood, as some accountability interview dynamics worked out, which I think is wrong. I think I just tried to ask him the questions in a straightforward way, including a hard question like, why did you get married? Which is a hard question in its simplicity. What was the low point? There are many. Well, what's one you would pick? Having to face my mother. I mean, I think that just takes you someplace. It's simple. It takes you someplace. But the night before, it did blow up, and I did throw up on my shoes. I just told myself, I'm never going to look anything up again. I don't need to get the verdict from a faceless jury. And with my wife as my witness, I think she would tell you, I haven't really ever done it. offense. And social media, that's a different topic, but that's why many times, there would be the handful of times. And listen, Richard, I am far from, a high profile dealer at ESPN or in the media landscape. You and I both know that. So it isn't like I'm foregoing constant mentions or anything like that.
All right, everybody who listens to this podcast knows I'm not always the smoothest with transitions. But let me tell you what is smooth, and that is Barbasol. You know them for their shaving cream. And now the biggest thing to happen to Barbasol since shaving cream is also the only thing to happen to Barbasol since shaving cream. Introducing new Barbasol razors. It is the brand America trusts for a close, comfortable shave, and they now have premium disposable razors. Barbasol's close shave technology on every razor means you get an advanced pivoting head and ultra-thin open-flow blades. The Ultra 6 Plus razor also features a seventh blade specifically designed to refine and style tricky areas like under the nose, sideburns, and your beard. Visit Barbasol.com and get a $2 savings coupon and see for yourself why Barbasol razors are the number one disposable razors out there. You're looking good, America. You're shaving with Barbasol. All right, back with Tom Rinaldi. Of course, my thanks to Barbasol. Always good shaving cream. Tom, your father was a stonemason. Your mom was a bank teller. After you graduated from college, you became a high school English teacher and a coach, including at a public high school in the South Bronx. Then you went to our shared graduate school alma mater, Columbia University.
Yes, and clearly
that changed the course of your career path and journey. What was it at a certain point when you were teaching that you decided I wanted to tell stories as opposed to I wanted to teach?
I loved teaching. I loved coaching. I'm thrilled that I did it, and I think it changed me a lot as a person. Both stops, the private school, Shadyside Academy in Pittsburgh, a fantastic school, as well as Morris High School, a great school in the South Bronx, Colin Powell's alma mater.
Oh, wow.
A place where I think that I realized for the first time, Richard, how sheltered I was in what I had experienced. At the time, Morris was in the poorest congressional district in the United States. Like many zone schools, New York City has school choice. Like many zone schools, it drew an incredibly wide range of students. And with that mix, there were students who had great aspiration. There were students who had great challenge. There was violence. There was achievement. There was sort of a, life's rich pageant, if you will. But one thing that was absolutely common between Pittsburgh and the Bronx was on graduation days, I would get to see students in different numbers, albeit, and heading off to different places and pursuits. And I would think, where am I going? Where is my adventure? And that's ultimately the spark that led to my applying to Columbia. To my absolute shock, I got accepted, and it was a tremendous. It was 1 year at the time that I went. Was it when you were there?
Was it 1 year when I was there?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still to this day, generally speaking, it's 1 year, but it's a little longer now. It's like
exactly.
I think when we were there, it was September to May. It's now more of a August to May, June thing.
Gotcha. So we were there sort of in a one school year
correct
time, and it was just a tremendous experience for me. I loved it. I mean, I didn't know my way from, I didn't know what a lead was. I didn't know the first thing about being a reporter. I knew that I loved stories. I loved reading them. I was a huge newspaper reader and magazine reader, as everybody from, John Wertheim to Austin Murphy, to Lee Jenkins, to all the guys who I've sort of crossed paths with or tried to reach out to at different times, Price. I have been a reader of SI from the time I'm a teenager, and as much as anything, SI is one of the reasons why I do what I do now.
That's nice of you to say.
It's true. No. And I'm not trying to curry favor. It's just true.
No, I've heard that. I know you've met some of our guys along the way, and we both share the same sports journalism professor, Sandy Padway, who
awesome.
Yeah, who always who has noted when I've talked to him in the past, sort of your love for long form, the written long form word. All right, I'm a couple more here for me, and then I'm gonna go fast with you in terms of I got a lot of questions. When I put this out on, not that you saw this, Tom, but when I put it out on Twitter that you were going to be a guest. This is interesting to me because this is a guy who's been on my podcast many, many times. I know him well. And this always strikes me, or this always struck me when he told me the first time, and it stayed with me knowing I would interview you one day. Jim Miller, the author of the ESPN Oral History, told me, "You are the only person who turned him down for an interview for that book," which I find fascinating. Why did you decline Miller when he asked you for the interview?
Because the work speaks for itself, Richard. And I hope that doesn't sound pompous or aloof or anything else. Just the work stands for itself, brother. Again, I don't look at the internet. It's you do the work and you go forward. Did you honor the people who you dealt with directly? And there's no disrespect. He's obviously a tremendously successful author. And I wasn't making some great stand or anything. You know, in fact, I didn't even know I was the only person until you told me that.
Yeah.
I thought there were a handful of others that didn't talk to him. And I hope I didn't offend him. But there's just no reason whatsoever to talk with him that I saw.
Interesting. Now, the book got done, so I'm not sure how offended he was.
Good point.
Right.
I mean, it didn't hurt him. We'll put it that way. It did not hurt him one bit.
Yeah, he was able to. He was able to finish.
Yeah.
I really, it's horrible for me to ask you this, but I need to ask. Like, are you more of a fan of violins, harps, or the piano?
So I'll tell you this. I recently celebrated a milestone birthday, and we gave out shirts for the wonderful revelers who joined in. And on the back, it just says no strings or piano. Harp, I think, is you being egregious and a little bit hurtful. But I'll let it slide.
That's fine. I like this answer that you gave on the Solid Verbal podcast. Always a good podcast.
Oh, God. Those guys killed me on the mock tribute, whatever the heck.
Yeah,
they're
good at Rinaldi-ing it up. But you said, this was in a serious note, you said the two beats that you are most interested in is living and dying in greatness. And that's why you're in sports as opposed to news. Is that correct? That sports provides you with all of the things that you want as compared to, let's say, if you had the opportunity to be a White House correspondent or covering conflict, let's say, in Chechnya.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the reason why I'm in sport, but sport, I think, within a pre-existing passion, as we've talked about, Richard, it does provide that because I am able to have the balance of, you know, being there for Federer winning the 8th Wimbledon and 19th major, greatness, the chance to talk to him, you know, as the first guy off the court, which is incredible.
Right.
And then also to document a story as tragic as it is about Logan. The dynamics of the job that I have allow for both of those things, but I will forever be compelled by the line between living and dying, and compelled by greatness always. And I mean, the greatness part, I think, maybe speaks for itself. But the line between living and dying, maybe selfishly here, Richard, is just it's a constant reminder and an endless lesson to me.
Tom,
things I need to learn and be grateful for.
I don't mean to be. I don't mean to be stereotyping here, even though part of my. Even though part of my question will be, but you interview a lot of college football coaches, and we're allowed to curse in this podcast. I find so often college football coaches, in particular, and college administrators, to be full of shit. I'm just going to be blunt with you. So, but when you are in, and this is not to say I think someone like Nick Saban is. But when you are interviewing someone within that universe, maybe Saban's not the right example because he's sort of a different cat there. But
interesting. Hold on, before you move off there, that's interesting. Now, what's different?
Well, I think what's different is he. I don't feel like Nick Saban pretends to be anything that he's not. He's a single-minded, oriented. I don't necessarily have time for all the BS outside of my coaching. I'm not going to try to play the, you know, I'm Johnny Charisma with the media game. Now, I think he, He could be, you know, he could quite frankly be a jerk at times, but in a way I respect his consistency, generally speaking, with the media. He can lecture, but he also, listen, he's also arguably the greatest college football coach of all time, and when you win, yeah. You get away with stuff. Belichick can get away with stuff that others can't. That's just the reality. But this is my horribly asked, long-winded, non-John Sawatsky like question to try to get you're in a position where you have to do these interviews, Tom, because you are the rights holder for ESPN. But there has to be times when you kind of know, like, you're getting a bullshit answer. You're getting coaching cliche. What do you do in those situations? Do you just proceed forward because the paycheck is great and you work for ESPN, or, and you know, behind the scenes you're hitting a punching bag? Like, what happens in those situations? Because that would frustrate me, I think.
All right, here's an example. Crimson Tide, they lose the national championship, right, with 1 second to go. 1 second left, they lose the national title game. You know, all the other things that were at stake, but let's just put it there.
Right.
They lose the national championship. All right, Rinaldi, go get Saban out of the locker room. Can I tell you, Richard, it took me forever to come up with the most obvious question there is. And I can't believe how long it took me to come up with this. He came out, right? I don't know if it was the first or second question I asked him, but I asked him, what went wrong?
What he said?
I thought his answer was terrific. His answer was, listen, we knew that we had to try in some way to limit the number of snaps that they were going to have offensively. And if you look at where we were in the first half or even entering the fourth quarter, you can't allow that many plays for your defense to be out there. I mean, he said something along those lines, but his answer was real. Just as his answer was to the other question I asked him, what was your message, you know, in that locker room right now? And he said he thanked the players. He was very proud of them. But I believe, Richard, he might have said, or maybe he just said this to me later, don't waste this failure. How great is that?
Yeah, it's a good line.
It's more than a good line. It's just it's a great thought.
Yeah, it's a mantra for life. It reminds me of the De Niro movie with Chaz Palminteri about the worst thing in life is wasted talent. I don't know if that was De Niro's line to the kid in that film, but that's very
The Bronx Tale.
Yeah, Bronx Tale. There you go. It's very similar to that. I like that. All right, this is from Scott Van Pelt. How does Tom Rinaldi feel about how much better my tie pocket square combinations are than his?
So let me tell you something. Scott Van Pelt will walk into a golf remote or will be at the Masters. Listen to this. Think about how insufferable this is. He'll simply walk in all 6'7", and he has the pocket square. I wear it straight across. He's got it with the, you know, the bouffant look that I can't manage and pull off. And he'll simply make a vague hand gesture in the direction of the pocket square, and which is awkward enough if you can picture it, not that you'd want to. But then he'll simply utter a word like filthy. And then he'll just continue on down. Some people can pull that off and some people can't. I know my limitations.
It's like it's like Burgundy-esque there. I like that. Ron Burgundy. Do you know off the top your single most awkward or tough interview that you've done live?
Live. Wow. I think I know on tape, but live.
What's the one on tape? I'll take the one on tape then.
I think potentially the one on tape. We did a feature. We did a feature with Mark Richt. And I won't get into all the specifics. Mark Richt, who is, I think, a very interesting guy and who's got a fascinating story in terms of his family. But it was a very personal story about his family, and he did not like a couple of the questions I was asking about one of his daughters. That was a tough moment. Yeah, and I give him a lot of credit. I stopped the interview, Richard, because I could tell that I was really bothering him. And we talked. We took a break. We talked a little bit, and then he came back, and, you know, he did the rest of it.
All right.
That was a tough moment.
All right, let's finish up with this. You, given the fact that you've dealt with a lot of stories that involve tragedy or death, they're tough sometimes. Have you ever broken down in the midst of either writing a piece or reporting a piece? Not obviously not going to break down on air or during narration because you'll retape, but has that happened where you've been so affected you just emotionally break down?
Never. Ever in front of a subject. Never in front of a subject.
Okay, never in front of a subject.
Never in front of a subject. But have I left a room or gotten together with a producer in the minutes after, you know, a particular interview, a particular moment that we've documented? And yeah. I think, again, if you're human, that's the natural response.
Tom, as someone who covers tennis, obviously I don't cover it like my buddy John Wertheim, but I've covered the last, I'm taking a guess here, 15, 16 U.S. Opens and been to Wimbledon, et cetera. I don't believe I have ever seen a better athlete with the press than Roger Federer, who is at the level of greatness of Roger Federer. So we're talking about the Messi, Gretzky, Brady, you know, et cetera level. For you, do you feel the same way? Or is there someone maybe in your orbit who tops Federer in terms of someone who's got that athletic greatness, yet is that media accessible?
Yeah, he's absolutely incredible. We did a 25-minute sit-down with him the Saturday before the championships, Richard, on center court. Afterward, he stands up and think about this, and he just talks for another 15 minutes.
It just doesn't happen. Yeah, it's crazy.
That does not happen. And then he goes and he talks to the groundskeepers for 10 minutes. And Tony Gottsick, his agent, is, you know, trying to get him out. Like, you know, hey, let's gonna. No, he's just talking. But I will say, though, Steph Curry, I think, is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
I think, by and so is Steve Kerr. And I know, you know, it's obviously Steve Kerr has been a member of the media.
Yes.
But Steph Curry is pretty remarkable in terms of his accessibility. And in the handful of interactions, probably a half dozen times, so is Kevin Durant.
Interesting.
Very, very, very thoughtful. They're very, very thoughtful men.
Yeah, I like
And obviously they're MVPs, but I realize they're not Roger Federer, but they're MVPs.
Those are good. Curry's a really good one. I haven't dealt much with Durant, but I think Jenkins would say the same thing about Durant. So that's interesting.
Very thoughtful, Richard. Very thoughtful guy. Thoughtful guy to talk to.
All right, Tom, let's end with this, because this is a story that's very, very important to you. Of all the stories maybe that you've worked on, it strikes me that the one that, if there is one that stands above the rest, it's Wells Crowther, who is the famously the man in the red bandana during 9/11. He was a Boston College athlete, worked in the South Tower, volunteer firefighter, helped save a group of people by ushering them down a stairwell to safety, and he did that multiple times in the South Tower until obviously he passed away on 9/11. You wrote a book or co-wrote a book on Wells, and it obviously, just given the significance of 9/11, it would be a monumental story. But am I correct, Tom, in sort of in, even though you've obviously done some remarkable work and done, you know, reported on very, very remarkable people, that strikes me as just maybe the story for you that, for whatever reason, just stay with you most. And maybe you were if I said you co-wrote it, I think I'm wrong about that. I think that you are the author of the book, which was a New York Times bestseller. So let's just end on Wells and why that story, for whatever reason for you, just is the story.
The line between living and dying. And I don't know that any story that I've ever covered personifies that, exemplifies that more than Wells' story does. my brother Richard worked on the 81st floor of the South Tower for a decade and a half, and was transferred from the Japanese bank he worked for into a Midtown location just a short time before 9/11. My sister worked across the street at the World Financial Center. She was on maternity leave at the time, but was scheduled to have an early morning meeting on 9/11, which, you know, the night before got postponed. Again, those stories are, as you know, one of thousands, tens of thousands of stories for people who live in and around the New York area. I did not when 9/11 happened. I lived in Los Angeles at that time. But it's so much about the day, what the day has meant to the history of the nation. And in this case, choosing to write a book about it, and we've just been really, really pleased by the fact that the book was received the way it was, is there's something about that day beyond the facades of buildings falling, but the day rendered through the lens of a single life, and ultimately a single life lost. And what Wells did before he died in that last hour of his life. And I'm close with his family. Drew Gallagher, the tremendous producer, works on College Football and Game Day now. But he went to school with Wells, was a classmate of his. He produced the original feature back in 2011 about Wells that ESPN has aired every year since in or on or around 9/11. So it's a story that will forever resonate with me. I've been surprised, Richard, at the different stories that I've had the chance to be a part of telling, again, with the producers and editors and crews that we have. But the story which people have mentioned to me most often has been that one. It's been that one.
The book is The Red Bandana, A Life, A Choice, A Legacy. It's on Amazon. Search it either for that title or Tom Rinaldi. I highly recommend it. It's a New York Times bestseller. And if you're an ESPN watcher, you most likely have seen the feature on Wells. It's easily one of the best things ESPN's ever done. Tom, I appreciate you taking the time to do this podcast. You were certainly, when I started this, on the list of people I wanted to talk to. I apologize that we don't have the budget like other podcasts so that I can play you off with orchestra music or violins or pianos. It will just be me going cold and thanking you for participating in the Sports Illustrated Media podcast.
No strings, no piano. Much better. Much better, Richard. And can I just end with one thing?
Sure,
just
sure.
You know, whenever, you know, you say such wonderful things to me and it makes me feel great, can I tell you, it puts in mind one tweet that somebody sent me and one heckle that someone said to me. And they have two things in common. And I'll end with this. The tweet was, Jim Cantore and Tom Rinaldi, the two people you never want to see in your town. That was the tweet. And the heckle, which was a couple of years ago at the PGA Championship, was a guy so excited to see me. He ran down half a fairway on the outside of the ropes, and he shouted out, hey, hey, you do a great job on the Weather Channel. I'll leave you, for all our serious talk, I'll leave you with that, Richard. Thank you so much for having me. I loved it.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Tom Rinaldi for a really interesting conversation. I appreciate him jumping on the podcast. Thanks to Lou Pellegrino and the folks at Digital Media, everybody at Sports Illustrated. Previous podcasts have been Ian Eagle of CBS Sports, Molly Solomon of the Golf Channel, Doug Ferguson of the AP. That was a golf-centric podcast. We've done a couple roundtables, including with Jim Miller, Ken Rosenthal of the MLB Network and Fox, James Duffy of TSN, Kevin Merida, the editor-in-chief of The Undefeated. If you like what you're hearing, you can get this on Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and a review. You could also get these podcasts on Stitcher and SoundCloud. For everybody who helped with this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.